Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. This is another edition of our Prospect Handbook podcast. And the Prospect Handbook podcast is brought to you by DraftDay.com. DraftDay.com is a new concept that offers short-term or daily fantasy sports games for real money. The concept is simple. You pick the day you want to play instead of fantasy lineup. If your picks perform well that day, you win. You can play for free or real money, and they award cold hard cash nightly to the top performing players. They've already awarded more than $10 million, and it's completely legal to play. DraftDay.com also has a new rapid fire game that takes 1 minute to play with huge payouts. Just pick between a few choices of players and choose the ones that will score the most points. It's that easy. All you need is 3 of 5 correct to double your money. DraftDay is offering a special offer to Baseball America listeners, so be sure to head to DraftDay.com and enter the promo code BAPODCAST, and that'll start you off with a free instant cash bonus. If you like free money, head to DraftDay.com and use promo code BAPODCAST. Once again, we want to thank the folks from DraftDay.com for sponsoring the podcast all year. And, JJ, this is one of our funner podcasts of the year because it's one of the ones that I think makes what we do at BA a little bit unique in another way, is that we like to talk about our process. We like to talk about our flair. And we're going to talk about our process of how we chose Byron Buxton as our minor league player of the year. We had a great announcement yesterday where a great story by Matt Eddy, and then a really fun interview with you and Byron Buxton. First of all, with Byron showing his determination.
Yeah, we had some technical issues, and he stuck with it and worked them through.
Technical issues at home, and then Byron went to the library and made it work. And we really want to thank Byron Buxton and the folks over at Jet Sports Management for making that possible. And I just thought it was fun to use the Google Hangout and to talk to Byron. And Byron Buxton came correct in the interview yesterday as well. This is a confident guy who he knows that he's good. He doesn't have to scream it from a mountain most high, but you can just tell the confidence that Byron Buxton has, and that he wasn't very surprised by having a minor league player of the year caliber season.
No, but at the same time, though, he made it very clear, like, no, I think there's still a lot I need to work on. He
right.
said, really, his off-season to-do list, one of it is to get stronger. And that is, I mean, a lot of that's just going to happen by getting older.
He's 19.
He's 19. He'll turn 20 in December. And as he, you know, as he fills out, he's never going to be, I'm sure we'll get into the words Mike Trout at some point in this. He'll never be Mike Trout from the standpoint of Mike Trout at 19. You know, we were getting the Brian Urlacher and Cleats comparisons.
At 19, Mike Trout had his man neck. I don't know about if he had his man strength. He was close, but he certainly had his man neck.
That's never going to be Byron Buxton. Byron Buxton is always going to be a more live, agile, you know, it's going to be, he's always going to have a smaller frame.
It's just a different body, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I do think Matt Eddy in his story made a good point that, yeah, we're comparing the tools and all those kind of things to Trout, but physically, the comparison that makes more sense really is Andrew McCutchen.
Right.
He's a little bit bigger than Andrew McCutchen, but he's certainly closer to McCutchen physically, and I'm talking about the frame and the musculature and all those things, than he is to Trout. Because Trout, again, is just a physical beast. I mean, he's like a linebacker.
The way I put it was is that if you had the two of them together and you put Byron Buxton in front of Mike Trout, you'd see plenty of Mike Trout.
I like
if you put Mike Trout in front of Byron Buxton, I don't know if you know that Byron was behind Mike Trout.
I'm here. I'm back here. But I think Mike Trout's traps block out the sun.
Right.
You know,
so
the Chinese thought that his traps were dragons that ate the sun every day. Sorry.
But you know, it is something where it was, I felt like this was one of the most interesting and the deepest player of the year classes. We've had years, I remember, where
very
it was
deep.
There were years where we're like, you got to give it to someone. I mean,
yeah.
And the year I remember that with was the Jeff Francis year.
That was the toughest
one. I was not here for the John Roush year, which from everything I remember the John Roush year. The John Roush year was one of those two.
It was. That was one where, in retrospect, if you could have done it over again, you would have liked to have done Roy Oswalt instead of John Roush. We chose the wrong Olympic gold medalist. But I think the guy that we wanted to choose that year was Rick Ankiel. And I forget what the flaw was in Rick Ankiel's
case. Was it
innings? I believe it may have been innings pitched. I believe that he also, he was on a pitch count. I'm going to look that up as you continue. But this was one of, if not the deepest classes that we've had in my tenure.
The way I put it is and we'll start by explaining something. We've explained this every year. We'll explain it again next year, I'm sure. Our Minor League Player of the Year Award is not. We do not claim in any way, shape, or form that we are awarding simply award to the guy who had the best season in the minor leagues.
If we were
we
doing
never
that,
have, we never will.
And if we were doing that, we probably would have given it to Chris Colabello.
Mm-hmm.
Because Chris Colabello probably had the best year of any minor leaguer this year.
He was up and down a little bit, so his counting stats are a little bit behind.
Because he only played, I think, 86 games.
Right, but he did qualify. He qualified among leaders.
89 games.
And he led all minor leagues in batting average. He led all minor leagues in slugging percentage. He led all minor leaguers in on-base plus slugging, and he was fifth in on-base. He had George Springer had a great year. But if you give Springer some advantage for he's a center fielder, you know, Colabello's a first baseman.
Also a corner outfielder at times.
Right, a corner outfielder at times. And also if you give that Springer obviously is faster and all that.
Right.
The reality of it is that when you compare also the Texas League and the Pacific Coast League to the International League, I think Colabello had the best year.
He had the best offensive season of anybody in the minor leagues. I think that's just clear. But that was the best minor league season.
But that's not what we award.
That's not our award.
And it never has been. Our award.
And it never will be.
Our award is, you essentially, it's a balance. Okay, it's season that you had, this 2013 season, combined with prospect status. Now, it's not the best prospect in the game by any stretch of the imagination.
That's not
Byron
what it's
Buxton won
be.
It this year.
Yes,
but that and he is the best prospect in the game.
Well, Myers won it last year, and I don't think we thought he was the best prospect.
He
was among the clutch of best prospects,
right.
But he wasn't the best prospect.
But the best way I can put it is, as I see it at least, is it's a sliding scale.
Correct.
I'm trying to think of a guy. I hate to say it. I'm sorry. If Chris Colabello hit .450 this year, he wouldn't have been because he's a 29-year-old.
Chris Colabello could not have won this award.
Right.
Period.
That being said, if we go on a different, let's say, okay, to pull a guy out, let's say Mookie Betts,
yeah,
who kind of came out, you know, who is a prospect. He's young. I mean, he's young for the league and all that. But let's say Mookie Betts had, which he didn't, he had a very good year. But let's say that he went 400, 500, 500 this year at second base.
Right.
I think he would have been our minor league player of the year, even though we may have thought that Mookie Betts long term is a solid prospect, a very good prospect.
That's a great question.
But I think that
would Mookie Betts with a 1,000 OPS have been our minor league player of the year over Byron Buxton with a 9 whatever it was OPS?
If you, you know, with hitting 400 to go with it, you know, I think you probably
would have been close.
It would have been close. I really, as I see it, you have to clear a certain bar to be in
of
prospectness to be in the discussion, and then there's a sliding scale involved with.
Yep.
Again, if you want to make the argument. You know, because really, I felt like this year, if you said, who are guys who would cross the bar as their season with minor league player of the year worthy? Okay. Buxton, George Springer,
mm-hmm.
Javier Baez,
yep.
Archie Bradley,
yep.
C.J. Edwards, who am I forgetting?
I would say Miguel Sano.
Miguel Sano, Michael Franco.
I would say Michael Franco, who didn't even make our first team. You could throw Joey Gallo into the discussion. I don't think he would have been there.
I was going to say, I do think when you strike out at that rate and you're doing it in low A, I mean, really it was a power-based year. I probably would have said, no, I don't think it reaches the threshold. But he did hit 40 homers.
40 homers is 40 homers.
I mean,
that's just hard to do. And I would say that Xander Bogaerts is and Carlos Correa are toward the back of that discussion.
Carlos Correa, to me,
but
absolutely.
Both those guys
18-year-old in the Midwest League who had the year he had while also – to me, the stat that I love with him is fielding percentage is not the best defensive stat, but there's something to be said for leading the Midwest League shortstops in fielding percentage, making 15 errors all year as an 18-year-old shortstop. That doesn't happen.
Right. I would also say Rossell Herrera, just from a he's in the Mookie Betts discussion where he's a good prospect, not a great prospect, and he had a ridiculous year. And I would say that Asheville kind of throws these things off because I think we don't quite know what to make of just how offensive Asheville is.
I always love to just throw in, okay, do remember, here are the dimensions at Asheville.
Right.
Under 300 down the line in right, 373 in center, 325 or so in left. That is...
And the right field is like 290, and it's like a... It's not even like a... The wall's not even like as high as like Camden Yards. Like
right.
If it were a Camden wall, Yards wall, it'd be one thing. But it's really not. It's like it's 15 feet maybe. It's
right.
If I recall correctly, I mean it's been a long time since I've rocked and rolled. It's also been a long time since I've been to McCormick Field. But I did used to park my car there when I graduated Asheville High. And That was the old ballpark, but they haven't. They didn't replace the field. They just replaced the dimension, the ballpark structure, and it wasn't a high field back when I saw Bob Abreu play
there. And the reality of it is that there's been a long list of guys who've had great years in Nashville. You have to have a little skepticism. I mean, Joe Koscienski, look up the year he had there. It was a monster year. Really, you look at last year. I mean, I still think he's a prospect, but shortstop.
I forget who had the big year there. Oh, yeah, Trevor Story.
Trevor Story, he went to Modesto, which, again, is still not exactly – this is not going to the
right.
Carolina League or anything.
Right.
You know, he went to a great place to hit, and he had a really backed up this year.
His first 2 months outrageously bad. Will Swanner's another one, good one.
He did the same thing. So there's a little bit more skepticism there. But at the same time, Herrera
If you can't hit at Asheville, you probably should go try to be an NFL quarterback like Russell Wilson. He couldn't hit Nashville.
That's true. But I think all those guys, I'm sure I might even be leaving someone out, but those guys all cross the threshold of, okay, they're in the discussion here. And then it pretty quickly becomes interesting from the standpoint of, okay, so how do we match these guys up?
Yeah, it was. I think the main point here is it was a historically deep crop. And a couple of things that stood out about this deep crop. First of all, it's really hard for a pitcher to win Minor League Player of the Year, JJ. Because I think to be Minor League Player of the Year as a pitcher, you have to, first of all, stay in the minor leagues all year. I'm looking back at Roy Oswalt's 2000 year again. Just had it here. Roy Oswalt was, again, just to tell you how different the era was, just in 2000, and Roy Oswalt nominally still active in the major leagues this year. He went 15-7. That's a lot of decisions. 2.21 ERA. He made 27 starts, 27 games, 26 appearances, 26 starts. He had 175 innings pitched, 33-188 walk to strikeout ratio. If somebody did that this year in High A and Double A, we probably would name the minor league pitcher player of the year with that season. That's a pretty great season.
That's a pretty great season.
But also 175 innings would stick out like a sore thumb. The only people who do that anymore are Rockies pitchers. Christian Bergman, I think, had a year like that this year. But prospects like Archie Bradley didn't come close to that. Archie Bradley threw 152 innings. That's like four starts, 25 innings, 23 innings difference. Like four starts these days. So
I mean, Tyler Glasnow, who wasn't going to win the award, but Tyler Glasnow, who I don't think, if I remember correctly, was hurt at all this year.
No, 111 innings.
111, and some of that was control, but a lot of that was, you know, hey, you're in low A, we're going to keep you on a tight leash. He didn't qualify to be among the leaders. He ended up two-thirds of an inning short. If he had, he would have led opponent batting average by like 35 points.
So to me, statistically, the best season in the minor leagues was C.J. Edwards by a pitcher, for me. I know you can argue Eddie Butler, and I know you can argue Archie Bradley. He only threw 116 innings. Which is really unbelievable that he threw so few. And then, of course, he threw 10 more in the Florida State League playoffs. So on the year, the guy threw 126 innings and gave up 77 hits because he gave up one in two Florida State League playoff outings. So to me, he was the best pitching season in the minor leagues, and he's kind of almost in that Mookie Betts, a little bit better prospect coming into the year because he was number 14 on the Rangers list.
On a very deep list.
A very deep list. But, you know, he was kind of on the fringes of the discussion.
Really, to me, the only two pitchers who we really talked about in this discussion were Bradley and Edwards.
Yeah.
Tywan Walker had a good year, but I don't think it was good enough to really...
Eddie Butler had a great year.
We did talk about Butler briefly, but really what we came down to pretty quickly was these are good, very good years in the minors for pitchers, but each of them had something that you could say, okay...
Right.
You know, with Edwards, it was not enough innings and all. With Bradley, it really was the command. I mean, it was something... If he'd have had the year he had and probably, you know, and you see the walks were down from what it was, then that probably would have been more of a discussion.
To me, the kind of season you have to be minor league player of the year as a pitcher, you basically have to have a Madison Bumgarner type year and not do it in low A. The Madison Bumgarner's 2008 year remains, to me, that's the gold standard for a pitcher's minor league season because he went 15-3. So even though one loss in the minors really doesn't matter, he had this gaudy win-loss record, which just tells you from a big picture standpoint that he was that dominant. To me, suck it, Brian Kenny. This tells you how dominant he was.
I'll disagree with you because that means he was on a good team too.
I don't think so. I don't think that's all it tells you because he gave up 28 runs all year in 24 games.
I follow that, but
he gave up 20. I understand that it had to be a good team for that, but he gave up 28 runs in 24 games.
That's a great year. That's an amazing year.
It's beyond
but
that.
But that tells me the 28 runs in 24 games tells me that more than the wins.
Correct. It does. Yeah. But the wins tells you a little bit of that. It also tells you how good his team was.
Right.
But it tells you a little bit
more
about
than
his dominance
in the minor leagues.
It's not completely worthless.
But more than that in the minor leagues.
I don't want to give that
argument. No, but more than the minor leagues, what it tells you is that he's on a team that lets him pitch through the fifth inning.
Well, that's part of how you have to be in this discussion at
right.
all.
No,
I mean, it has nothing to do with the team. Tyler Glasnow wasn't.
Right. No, no.
You know, and that's part of this
well.
That's why Tyler Glasnow's not in it and Bumgarner is. That's what we're talking. That's kind of what we're talking about. But he also had an 8-1 strikeout to walk ratio.
No, it was
164-21. So that's you have to have all the components. For me, for a pitcher to win minor league player of the year, you have to satisfy, to me, old school criteria and new school criteria. He satisfied all of them. That's where I'm going.
Right.
That's
and
why I even
it,
do mention
guess,
wins.
Right, but I disagree with you in that.
I was going to say,
to me, if he'd have had that year, and it'd have been 8-2, I'd have said no difference to me.
I think that it does not recognize the fact that we have a lot of older readers and a lot of younger readers. And to win minor league player of the year, to me, as a pitcher, that's what I just said, you have to satisfy all criteria. You have to satisfy the old ones and the new ones. And I would fight you to the death on an 8-2, an 8-2 guy winning minor league player of the year. Because you have to me, the minor league player of the year is the player that you look back on 5 to 10 years from now and say that player meant that was the player who encapsulated, who was the talk of the minor leagues that year.
Mm-hmm.
And someone like Will Myers hitting 37 home runs, that was the talk of the minor leagues. That's why Jeremy Hellickson, while he was a good choice in 2010, Mike Trout would have been a better choice because he was the talk of the minor leagues that year. And that's really what we – sometimes it's hard to remember that. It's hard to remember that. But to me, that's what it is. It's not that you look back 5 years from that was the best big leaguer, you know, from 5 years ago. I think that was the guy who was the talk of the minor leagues. And usually you're the talk of the minor leagues for performance – and an 8-2 guy would not be the talk of the minor leagues. I really don't think so, unless he had 300 strikeouts.
Right. No, I was going to say
and he did, and he's not going to.
And that's you would have to be. It'd have to be a season where the guy was striking out, 12, 13, most every time out, things like that.
Right. And to do that, you're going to pitch 5, 6, 7 innings, and to do that. If you do that, you're going to pick up a lot of wins. It's just 15-3 does not tell you he was dominant. It's one small sign that he was dominant, but to dismiss it completely.
No, I'm not dismissing
it. I know you're not, but to say an 8-2 guy would win minor league player of the year, I think that you would be in the minority, and I think that would be very difficult to defend to an old school fan.
But,
and we have old school fans and new school fans.
Okay,
I don't value old school fans.
But
we're already there.
But we are there, I guess. Depends on what that 8-2 was. Like, let's say that he left. None of these guys are pitching 9 innings consistently.
Right.
Say you're on a team, bad bullpen, and you know what? He was 8-2, and 7 times he left the game winning, and then the bullpen blew it for him. I can explain that very easily.
But he didn't even win it that year.
No. I'm saying, I'm saying that to me, you have to. It's hard. You hit the key thing. You do that in low A as a pitcher. You're probably not going to win it.
Right.
No, we just named a guy who spent half the year in low A, spent half the year in high A. I think as a hitter, I agree with you completely. It is much easier because the reality is that, to me, as a pitcher, the history of pitchers who have dominant seasons in low A, and it doesn't tell you nearly as much as a guy age-appropriate having a dominant season. Victor Sanchez in the Midwest League this year.
Good example.
Very good year. If you just look at the numbers, you may say, wow, that guy's got to be a great prospect.
Right.
You look at the stuff.
Hey, but Madison Bumgarner's rotation mate in San Francisco right now says, hey, I think I had the better low-class A season over here, Yusmeiro Petit says. I mean, he may have. It was close.
Right. And that's the thing is that if you've got a pitcher, age-appropriate again, not like someone who's 25 and pitching in the Midwest League or anything, but if you've got a pitcher, Julio Urias, another example, he's 16. He's too advanced for low-A hitters.
I would say a guy in his situation who's getting pulled after 4 and 5 innings will never win minor league player of the year.
You can't.
But that's what I'm saying. That goes to my argument. You have to satisfy the new and the old school stats. You have to do it all as a pitcher.
Right, but I'm just coming back to that wins can be – you can have a great year and the wins were out of your control.
I understand that the wins, for the most part, are out of your control. I'm not debating that. But to win minor league player of the year, you have to have gaudy numbers everywhere as a pitcher. I think I'm winning this argument. You have to have gaudy numbers in every category. I'm not trying to say wins matter, but you have to just dominate because it's easier for a hitter. Just like it's the same thing as MVP. How often do pitchers win MVP? Not very often. I think that we're a smaller voter base, and we're more on the same page than the BBWA guys are. So, and we're less tied to old school statistics than the BBWA voters are. But for this award, for a pitcher to win it, Madison Bumgarner lost out that year to Matt Wieters, and Matt Wieters was, you know, killing bears with his pinky. You know, I mean, Matt Wieters, you know, was like telling he was showing Vladimir Putin how to pose with the shirt off. You know, to put it in a current context. So Matt Wieters was doing amazing things that year, but he was the talk of the minor leagues. So, but if Madison Bumgarner had done that at Double A, if he'd done that for 2/3 of the year, Double A, guess what? He'd have been in the big leagues.
That's really the other part of it. It's hard for a pitcher because it's hard. I don't think we've ever given it to a pitcher who did the majority of the damage in Low A.
You know, Petit's year was not even as good that year in 2004 as Bumgarner's. So, but Madison Bumgarner just was unbelievable that year.
But the other part of it is that as a hitter, you don't move up as quickly. Whereas the pitcher, if you're doing that, like, let's put it this way: if Jose Fernandez was a hitter, there's a very good chance he'd have started the year in Double A and spent a good bit of, you know, if that
he would
have
at least been half a year like Christian Yelich and Jacob Mariznick did.
Right. And if he had, considering how good he was in the majors,
yes,
he would have put up numbers that would have put him in consideration. But he jumped straight from High A to being, you know, in the Rookie of the Year consideration.
And Cy Young Award consideration, no doubt. No doubt.
And it's something where, to me, that is true, is that I give another example. Tony Cingrani, who put up some really gaudy, his minor league numbers were pretty amazing. That guy doesn't get really a whole lot of chances to win minor league player pitcher of the year because you move a lot quicker.
Yeah, so that's where we started off on this.
Yeah.
It's very hard. We just detailed for you how hard it is for a pitcher to win minor league player of the year.
So
I forgot what my other point was. So you got me all riled up about wins.
So now let me go on the we've explained the pitchers. Let's go on the hitters. Really, when it came down, at the very end, it was Springer and Buxton.
Right.
But let's go some of the other candidates first.
The depth was the other thing we were talking about.
Yeah, so that was a character. It's like Javier Baez, to me, the reason he ends up losing out in this, great prospect, younger than most of the guys in his leagues. The amount of home runs he hit in Double A in a half season is amazing. He made the Southern League All-Star team at the end of the year,
right,
the official team, even though he pretty much...
He played 54 games there.
Right.
You usually, when a 20-year-old moves up, this is usually one of the obstacles to winning Minor League Player of the Year for a hitter, is that this was an obstacle for Sano. You're a young hitter, and you're overmatching one level, and then you go up to a level like Double A or Triple A, and you stub your toe for a little bit, and you struggle, and that's why you don't put up the giant numbers to win Minor League Player of the Year. That kind of happened to Sano, at least for a month or so in the Eastern League, and then he had this monster August. But it didn't happen to Baez. He actually improved his case when he moved up. His error rate went down, and he hit for more power. That said, Javier Baez and Miguel Sano had extremely similar seasons, and to me that was one of the big issues for them, was separating the two. Who had the better season, Baez or Sano? That actually made it more difficult, and that was more... That's one of the things that separated Springer and Buxton from the group, was how unique their seasons were.
Well, to me also, with Baez, defense does matter somewhat. And while he's made strides in that, it's less of a slam dunk than it was when he was coming out of the draft, that this guy can't play shortstop. 41 errors this year, I think, was the final number.
I believe that's the case. It was a lot in the Florida State League. It was like
31, I think, in the
maybe
and then,
31,
and then I think, you know, but something like that. I don't, you know, someone can cite.
Don't quote us
because we're not looking it up while we do this on this podcast. But a ton of errors,
right?
And really, and an aggressive approach that led to a whole lot of power, but it wasn't something that he was hitting .330 to go with it. It was.
Yeah, and he also had like 100 more strikeouts than walks, and that ratio, the fact that he had a very pedestrian .340 on base percentage, to me made him a little bit less of a candidate than Sano. I thought Sano had a better candidacy.
Right.
Also, Sano, the Eastern League is a little less offensive than the Southern League, not by a ton, but a little bit less.
But to me, the problem with Sano was, is you want to talk about difficulty separating out Sano and Michael Franco.
Right.
I mean, because when you look at those two, then you're really talking about something where it's like two guys who played in the exact same leagues,
same
moved
position.
Up at playing the same position, who moved up at almost the same time. You throw all those things together, and the reality is that Sano was better in the Florida State League. You could argue that Franco may have been a little bit better in the Eastern League. Both of them had very solid cases, and again, in a different year, I think either of them would have been, you know, had a chance.
Those were both minor league player of the year caliber seasons, for sure. Would we say anybody? Cause, to me, Carlos Correa, as great of a year as he had, you know, he wound up not even making our minor league all minor league team because.
No, he did. He was the DH, wasn't he?
I don't think so. No, Joey Gallo is our second team DH, and we had Rosell Herrera as a second team shortstop.
Okay.
Because Rosell Herrera had a monstrous year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was again. This is just we're talking about the depth. It was a deep year, and when it came to the second team, I think Matt Eddy, you know, who really kind of runs
the spearheads that, yeah.
He really just thought that Herrera's season was more impressive from a performance standpoint, less impressive from a prospect standpoint, and it's debatable. It's certainly debatable. He went with Herrera. And then J.J., we really got down to Buxton to Springer. And
that's where we probably spent, if you said, again, explaining our process, we probably spent all together about, I'd say, 4 or 5 hours discussing this as a staff.
I would say
that 80% of that discussion was Buxton and Springer.
Yeah, it was not. It was in no way was that an easy discussion or an easy choice.
I think when we started the discussion, Springer was leading because we start talking about this about a month out.
Yeah, we could go find the emails.
And
but he was in
Springer
the lead.
Was leading, and really, a couple of things happened over the final month. For one, Byron Buxton had a monster final month of the season where he posted a 500-plus on base percentage that month. At the same time, George Springer, who was kind of making that run at 40-40, he's making that run, and then kind of tailed off a little bit at the end.
Yeah, it was impossible for him to maintain that pace. And this is the fact that he had 8 games in a row without a home run. But it does look a little bit more impressive. And this happened to Will Myers last year, too, remember? He led the minor leagues in home runs all year, and then somebody caught him at the end. Do you remember who caught him at the end last year? Because I don't. But somebody caught him right at the end of the season, and I think even passed him for the minor league home run lead. And that did not happen. And that same thing happened this year to George Springer.
Because Joey Gallo just,
Joey Gallo, who's on the cover of the latest issue of Baseball America, just had this monster fit.
Darren Ruff.
Darren Ruff.
Who had the monster month of all monster months.
I forgot. I knew it was somebody. I knew
somebody. Darren Ruff had the month. I mean, there's no such thing as a monster month more than what Darren Ruff did
in August
of last year.
Darren Ruff chuckles at me calling Joey Gallo's August a monster month. Because the guy hit 20 home runs in 1 month. So,
I mean, he went from being like not on the first page of home run leaders to leading the minors.
But the bigger thing, really, for me, wasn't that he didn't lead the minor leagues in home runs; that he just didn't adjust and kept on. And that's what we kept getting from scouts, and it's detailed in Josh Norris's story at BaseballAmerica.com, his first feature for BaseballAmerica.com that doesn't involve video. But it's that George Springer. Is going to be George Springer, and he's going to strike out. And it's almost like a Mark Reynolds stubbornness in some ways.
And we threw it out there basically. I emailed probably 10 people in the game and said, hey, so what do you think about Springer? You know, this was as we kind of got into this discussion and all, and got back a lot of answers. Almost no one said this guy is not going to be a solid big leaguer. Almost everyone thought this guy is going to be at least a solid big leaguer with a chance to be better than that.
We don't have anyone here comparing him to Melky Mesa.
No.
that's not happening.
That being said, we had a whole lot of people also saying, you know, the strikeouts worry me, and I do think that it's going to limit what he can do down the road unless he makes some significant adjustments. Maybe because he hasn't needed to yet. He hit 300 in the PCL with pretty much an approach that from all the scouts we talked to, it's a very inside-oriented approach. It's something where if I get a ball in the inside, you know, half,
right,
I'm going to yank it and probably hit a homer with it. And if you throw me a good strike on the out, you know, you, if you paint the black on the outside, I'm probably going to strike out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the comparisons on this power speed list, this chart that Matt Eddy did. Top power speed performance since 2004 with each player's strikeout percentage per plate appearance. The comps on this are not encouraging for George Springer. It's guys like Grant Desme. Oh, yeah, you can't judge Grant Desme.
Yeah, because we don't know.
He'll be the one doing the judging here. Terry Evans, Justin Maxwell, Greg Hallman, again, can't be judged. Charlton Jimerson, Nelson Cruz, Chris Young, Delman Young, Dan Carroll. I mean, that is just not an encouraging list.
And that is basically the best power speed guys as far as putting
up. In the last 9 full minor league seasons, or I guess 10, counting this 2004 season, 2013, 10 seasons, very nice comp list. And that's just not encouraging.
And that does not mean this is a pretty unique skill set.
Right.
So it doesn't mean
it's a desirable skill
set. Right.
So
and it does not mean, oh, okay, you know, well, clearly he's doomed now or anything like that. What it does mean, though, is just that it's hard to say that the unique skills of hitting a ton of home runs with a ton of steals in a minor league season destines you in any way for future greatness, because Delmon Young and Chris Young and I guess Nelson Cruz showing up on there is the part they're like, wait, Nelson Cruz?
Yeah, I know.
Because when I think power speed combos, I think Nelson Cruz.
He had 24 stolen bases and hit 37 home runs in 1 year. That's pretty good. I mean, the upshot of all this is that, first of all, his year to me came out as a little bit less unique. Number two, is that the strikeouts are a real concern, and that when you're evaluating the whole player. This isn't just the prospect. This is about the season. How sustainable is that? What he did was pretty impressive. So he's in this conversation. It's a very elite conversation. So you're having to split hairs. The other thing that, to me, dinged his candidacy a bit is that, yes, his biggest advantage to me over Buxton is the home runs.
Mm-hmm.
His second biggest advantage is that he did it Double A and Triple A.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he did it in Double A and Triple A in very offensive environments is what dings him down a little bit. And I thought I had a very interesting comment, which obviously was from a nom de plume or nom de keyboard of Byron from center field, but it was in the chat, and it says, by wins weighted runs created plus, which I guess is that a Fangraphs statistics?
Yeah,
I think it is. Measures all batting value and adjusts for park and league. Springer was 174 in Double A and 175 in Triple A. Buxton was 176 in Low A and 155 in High A. Considering that Buxton is a better defender and is more age advanced, I don't get these people's beef. Boils it down to, without needing the advanced statistics, the advanced metrics, I just know, I think it was a little bit harder for Byron Buxton to do what he did in the Midwest League and Florida State League, which we know are not offensive environments, than it was for George Springer to do what he did in the Texas League and the PCL.
To me, the big part, if you said what was probably factor two for me, was there's such a big difference in age here.
Right. That's another big one.
Springer did it at a higher level. Springer also did it at 23. He's in his second full year out of the draft.
Degree of difficulty.
Coming out of college. Buxton is doing it at the year where Springer was a freshman in college.
Right.
He's essentially 1 year behind Springer, because I think saying that, you know, that Buxton next year is going to spend the year in Double A and probably some time in Triple A and maybe beyond,
right,
is not going crazy in any way, shape, or form.
Correct.
He's a year behind, and he put up numbers that were right there, like where you can compare them and you can say, I mean, because, look, you can compare them in a lot of different ways, and the power for Springer, the 37 homers, is important. At the same time, what Buxton did as far as he was a leadoff hitter most of the year. No one was. I mean, he was an insane leadoff here, getting on base, stealing bases, showing power. He led the
right.
minors in triples.
I like triples.
He's better defensively. I think really right now, it's like if you said who's the best defensive center fielder in the minors, if it's not him, I would love to know who it is.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a spectacular talent, and so George Springer is as well. He's a spectacular talent who had a spectacular season. So for me, the more we dug into the Springer data, the more we backed off Springer. And it, but it was close. And
it
like
was very
you said,
close.
I think it is important to note, I didn't even say this in the chat yesterday, but when we started, the email chain was, we started with, yeah, it's George Springer. And the more we dug, the more we backed off that. And that's, you know, that that's not usually how it goes. Usually when we dig a little bit more, our first instinct, I think, is usually correct. And in this case, we didn't think our first instinct was correct.
We really, as we went into it, we knew coming into it, like, you can't find a scout. Let's talk about Buxton a little bit here.
Yeah, because you can't find a scout who says anything really negative about him.
I got a guy who's like, I may use this quote in the Midwest League Top 20, but I'm going to give you, I'll give you a sneak peek, podcast listeners, because you probably already know this. And we can give you two sneak peeks.
Two sneak peeks.
Byron Buxton is going to be number one in the Midwest League. John,
and
you're doing the Florida State League.
And Byron Buxton is going to be number one in the Florida State League.
Wait, I don't think we've given you any great.
You're only getting 38 prospects in those two leagues as opposed to 40. Sorry.
Yeah, you know two of them now. But I got a guy who said, well, I guess if you're really nitpicking, he doesn't switch hit. It'd be nice if he did.
I mean, right.
But that's it.
I seriously was I've been trying in all these Florida State League calls after the first couple, which were just like, oh, Byron Buxton. Since then, I've really been trying to bear down on negatives, and I can't get any from anybody. And I got one yesterday. I asked a manager, just straight up asked him, give me something negative. And he thought about it for, you know, 15, 20 seconds. I mean, like, the phone was quiet, you know. It was like a Kevin Towers, Dan Duquette trade call. It was just quiet. And then he says, you know, I can't come up with one. In fact, what I'm thinking of is where he laid down a bunt and beat it out to first by, I thought, a good half step. And the umpire called him out. And he whirled around for a second like he was going to confront the umpire. But then he saw his manager coming out, and I interjected, his manager can do the talking for everybody on the field, that being Doug Minkiewicz, who was my spokesman at the 2000 Olympics. Go-to quote of all time, go-to quotes. And he said, well, that's for sure. But he said, well, as soon as he saw Minkiewicz coming out, he put his head down and jogged into the dugout. And that level of maturity and is something else that stands out. The way he plays the game, JJ, stands out to the opposing managers as much as what he does on the field. Because and in the Florida State League, there were two of these guys we just talked about, Sano and Baez, where the way they play the game rubs some people the wrong way, and the way that his manager managed the game rubs some people the wrong way, and the way Jorge Soler played the game. You know, there was a lot of that in the Florida State League this year. And Buxton sit out again for that. So we're kind of making him sound like St. Byron here. But it really is difficult to find the negative.
The best way I can put it, though, is that, and I'm not saying that he is the best prospect of the time. I've been, you know, I'm in year 11, you're now year 17.
17.
But of that time, I'm not saying he's going to end up being the best player who's come through during that time. I'm not. To say that anyone is going, Mike Trout's only basically in finishing up year two right now. But to say that anyone is going to top what Mike Trout has done is really hard for me to project. I guess Albert Pujols fits,
yep,
is all in your era, and 99% of it's in
mine.
I
was just thinking, Albert Pujols' total of career is the best player who was a minor leaguer when I came to Baseball America and has had this massive major league career.
But I'm not saying he's going to match that. That being said, I can't, and I'll challenge you with the same question. I can't think of a prospect coming through the minors who scouts were more unanimous about just how confident they are in this player.
Yeah, Trout is the only one who approaches it. Because I remember doing that Futures League prep in 2010, and when we started getting the Urlacher comps on Trout, that's the one where like people were just shocked by his hitting ability. And then the fact that I was a little bit prepared for it with Trout because we had done that spring draft coverage in 2009 where Nathan Rohde, which is all about Trout, scouts up there love him, but they can't evaluate him because he's not hitting. The other guy who was sort of in that category to an extent was Hayward because there was that tantalizing, again, the physicality was such a standout.
And he also,
and
advanced,
he was also
hit.
Advanced hitting ability, advanced just the fact that he took pitches. He had advanced, but there also was a little bit of like, oh, I didn't get to see him. He was hurt, but I've heard all these great stories. So there was a little bit of that, and then also the tale of the guy who fell to the 14th round. There was a little bit of that with Trout as well. Buxton doesn't even have that because he was second overall pick. He was the top high school hitter. You know, like I linked yesterday in the chat to our first top 100 of the year, and he was number three on that list. It was Appel, Giolito before he got hurt, Buxton. So Buxton's been under this microscope for all that time and has lived up to all that.
But to put it this way, like, okay, trying to rewind, because I guess I would,
even
throw
Harper.
I would throw Matt Wieters coming out. Matt Wieters was another guy like...
That minor league season was so good.
When he was done with that minor league season.
Yeah.
But even then, there were scouts who were like, you know, I think his hitting approach is good, but I don't know if it's great.
And then there were other people who were saying, you know, he is still 6'6".
Right. I don't know if
he's always going to have some holes.
Right. You had that. Okay. So that, to me, there were knocks there.
Right.
Bryce Harper, the knocks were there were guys who were like, I think his, you know, it's great power. I don't know. You could find guys who said, I think he's going to be a 260, 40 home run guy.
Right. Absolutely. Jim Callis always, and that's, you know, to Jim's credit, he always had Trout ahead of Harper because of the hit grade, and so far that has certainly proven true.
Right. So you had that. Trout, I think, was the closest thing I can think of. I'm trying to go back further, but Trout was the closest. But even with Trout, because of how quickly, you know, how he moved,
yeah, I can't
in the Midwest League, in the Midwest League, guys really liked him.
Josh Beckett, I will say, from a pitcher standpoint, I think Josh Beckett was the way that scouts want their number one starter to be, because the hellacious fastball, the hellacious curveball, and the hellacious get out of the box. You know, just his mound demeanor when he was at his best, which I think we all saw in those two World Series, he helped carry those two teams to Boston and Florida. That I would say Beckett had that same level of anticipation, and where the only nitpick on him at the time was, well, you know, he's not quite durable enough. He doesn't, you know, those kind of things. But it was, you had to really.
And I'll
nitpick.
Go back. I'll go back, you know, to deep in my archives. But I saw
Jones?
Andrew. I saw Andrew.
Oh, okay.
Chipper's before.
Okay.
Chipper Jones, I didn't get to watch on a daily basis. But Andrew Jones, I saw him every day through his first of two minor league player of the year seasons. Amazing prospect. That being said, again, at the time, doesn't run, you know, you'd like to see a little more, great
right.
in the center, but at times he wouldn't run a ball out to first that you wanted to see. Had a hole in his swing because basically he was he's 17, just turned 18. He'll close it up, but right now you can get him out sliders on the outside.
Right.
He never closed that hole. It went on for the next.
See Springer, George.
But you have that. With Buxton, you have every scout you ask, like, man, his hitting approach, the power, I think, if you're getting a knock for him, it's like, he might only be a 20-25 home run hitter, not a 40.
That's the biggest knock, and especially in comparison to Trout, is that he does not have Mike Trout's power potential. That said, people didn't think Mike Trout had Mike Trout's power potential when he was in A-ball. And I still have guys telling me who've seen both that Buxton has fewer holes in his swing than Trout, has better hit ability. If Trout's not an 8 hitter, I don't know what is. So what's Buxton going to hit? it's really hard to.
Because what's interesting is that, to me, Hayward is a cautionary tale. I feel like watching Jason Hayward, whether it's that pitchers made adjustments to him and he had trouble making adjustments, or because of his swing or whatever, but Jason Hayward to me was a better hitter coming into his rookie season than he is now.
I think that's fair to say.
He's probably got more power now. But I remember me and you watching in spring training and going, just this approach is really more advanced than the average rookie.
It just never seemed like he swung at bad pitches.
And that's the
young
thing.
Player.
And that's Buxton. Buxton,
right.
You know, again,
it is.
The final month of Buxton's season in August was pretty much Florida State League pitchers deciding, we're not going to give you much. And Buxton's saying, that's fine. I'll get on base one out of every two times. And by the way, you don't want me on base because I'm also the fastest guy in this league.
I mean, I think that Phil Miller's org report this issue says that he has a six-tool disruption, and that's a great description of it, that he really is as disruptive a force. So I think George Springer had a fantastic year, JJ. I think Javier Baez and Miguel Sano and Archie Bradley and C.J. Edwards had outstanding years. Carlos Correa, Rosel Herrera, I think a lot. Michael Franco. We had a generous portion of.
It was a great
candidates.
Year in the minors.
It really was. It was a great year in the minor leagues. And locally here, we just wrapped up our last home game with Durham playing, winning its second game.
Where is the AAA championship this year?
AAA championship is in Lehigh Valley. The IL championship moves on to Pawtucket now. That series is tied at one. So I took in the last home game last night. Fun just to go as a fan. Matt Eddy there is a fan, former BA-er, Will Kimmy there is a fan, so he got a little reunion with one of his old favorite players, Mark Hamilton of Tulane, who's apparently growing his hair to try to make up for Will's hair. But so kudos to Mark Hamilton for doing that, seeing as how Kimmy was one of his favorites, he was one of Kimmy's favorites. But it was a great year in the minor leagues, and we do have a couple Twitter questions we'll get to about that. Japers, long time, not first time, definitely not first time, but definitely long time, asks, assuming it doesn't get overmatched at higher levels next season, could you envision Buxton getting a September call-up? I would answer, I could see him getting a call-up before September. I could see him earning it, and the Twins, I think, are extremely ready to turn the page as a franchise to the Sano-Buxton chapter, or the Buxton-Sano chapter. And that chapter can't get here soon enough for most Minnesota fans. I think it can't get here soon enough for the Twins. And you know, Ron Gardenhier, I think his contract ends at the end of this year as well. You could see a lot of changes in Minnesota, and why not? They have been very bad at the major league level for three straight years, and it's bad and not exciting. You know,
it's a boring brand of bad, which that's bad too. Like
yeah.
Boring bad is bad.
There's no who is the young player in the big league team right now that you're going to build around. I guess on the big league roster right now, it's kind of Oswaldo Arcia. You hoped it would be Aaron Hicks, but he had a brutal first half, and they rushed him. So the fact that Hicks struggled so much in the first half, and then struggles as being sent back down, might temper the Twins. But Buxton's hit tool is so much more.
Well, I was going to say you could say they rushed Hicks. In some ways, they didn't. Though Hicks has had 4 years in the minors.
Well, they didn't rush him, and then they did. That's the weird part. They made him repeat
slow,
low A.
Slow, 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 fast.
That was the weird part, is that he jumped over AAA from AA. And, you know, part of that is that they didn't have any other center fielders. You know, they traded two of them.
They looked at Darren Mastroianni, and they went, okay, we...
Well, he got hurt. I think Mastro would have been the perfect fill-in this year, and then he hurt his ankle.
And then they went, okay, we don't have any other choices, so then...
Right. Their choice was Cleet Thomas or Aaron Hicks.
And they chose...
Aaron Hicks, and as the guy in Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade says, they chose poorly. So.
Well, I do think, yeah, I think that Buxton, you send him AA to start the year, but you kind of have in the back of your head, you have the plan, he's going to spend most of the year here, we'll promote him to AAA, and in 2000, and even with that, I think
you say
in 2015.
Say publicly, you say that.
Yeah,
you
know, but in the back of your head, you say, okay, if he does the same thing this upcoming year that he did this year, I don't think their plan. They did not write down at the start of the year, Byron Buxton a half year in the Midwest League.
Yeah.
That's not how the Twins do things. That being said, like, I got to see him in June, and you're watching him, and you say, like, the cliche is, a guy will tell you when he's ready to move up. And I came back and I said,
yeah,
I've never seen a guy tell you more that he's ready to move up, because everything you saw was like, these pitchers, it was almost like, okay, well, and he was fear bearing down. It wasn't like he was taking it lackadaisically or anything, but they could not challenge him. Like, now Lance McCullers could. Lance McCullers could go up there and go, I've got two plus pitches. What can you do? And he struck out Buxton a couple times.
Right.
You're not seeing Lance McCullers on an average night. On an average night, there was just not much that could challenge him in that league. They had to move him up. I think he goes to AA, and if he has a first half season in AA like he did this year, then you start, at that point, you really start thinking, okay, so when does he arrive? Because, again, we've heard the argument of many time and time again, a lot of guys don't need a whole lot of AAA time.
Right.
Especially, you know.
Especially today. I mean, if you can do, and we saw a lot of guys jump from AA to the big league this year and make that jump pretty well. And this guy's hitting ability is advanced enough for him to survive.
He was a Marlin.
Yeah, he would have been in the league this
year. We could look at opening day 2014 and say, oh, he's your center fielder.
Yeah, so, I mean, the only way to me that he's not up before September is, A, he stumbles, which I don't think is likely. B, gets hurt. Or, C, that Aaron Hicks rediscovers something that he lost this year.
Well, I think if that happens, even if Buck's doing what he'd say, okay, Aaron Hicks,
you're
a right fielder.
I'm just saying that they would try to pause things, especially from a financial standpoint or from a tempering expectations, because if they're losing next year, I think it's easier to call them up. But if they're in it, and Aaron Hicks is one of the reasons they're in it, why rock that boat? So I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
I think the main way that Aaron Hicks would help them in the major leagues be in it is if he were pitching. So, speaking of McCullers, funny you should say that, because Lex the Pex asks, Alex Sandoval, where should Lance McCullers Jr. start next season? And should top pitching prospects skip Lancaster? So those are two questions. I personally think it would help him to go to Lancaster. You're going to pitch in offensive environments in the major leagues.
Maybe not. Maybe not the freak show that is Lancaster.
It's a freak show.
It's a freak show because Lancaster. It depends on the day. You can have days at Lancaster where it's just an offensive ballpark, and you can have days where you know, okay, if they hit the ball in the air, it's out.
Right.
And
right.
That's the insane part of it.
And not an out. It's out as in a home run.
Right. I mean, it's like okay, it's again. They've had games like okay, we had to delay. We got blowing rocks here. You know, I mean. Because 45.
Oh,
the big, sorry, right. But Lancaster has had games delayed for wind because it's been so windy. But
I loved back when he was a minor league.
Dirk Hayhurst.
When he was a nobody. But Dirk Hayhurst, when first of all his hair was really long, and second of all he just showed the wind in Lancaster. It was really mind blowing just to see it on video.
You put your cap up and it just disappears.
Yeah, it was 40-mile-an-hour gusts. And
like I don't even know if it was gust. It was more like 40-mile-an-hour straight line winds.
It was like.
I do think that you probably put him on the plan, much like what the Diamondbacks did with Archie Bradley this year. You send him there, and you're really hoping if he shows you any success at all, that you can move him on and move him out of there and get him out of the insanity that is that place. But you have to sit down with anyone going to Lancaster and basically explain, like, look, what we're focused on here is not – results from the standpoint of we don't much less of are you, you know, 5-2 with a 2.5 ERA.
Right.
What we're focused on, are you making good pitches?
There's nowhere more process oriented than Lancaster.
If you're making good pitches, if you're hitting your spots, if you're improving your changeup, because to me, that is task 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 for Lance McCullers. If you're Lance McCullers, if you don't want to end up as a reliever, it doesn't have to be great. His two main pitches are so good that it doesn't have to be great.
Right.
But it has to be a lot better than what it was this year.
It has to be playable. I mean, we just saw it, speaking of the Astros, we just saw it with Carlos Rodon in July against Cuba. His changeup was really good that night. It was probably a major league average changeup. But when the fastball is a 7/8 and the slider is a 7/8, the changeup ain't got to be more than a 5.
If it's a 5, you're a dominating pitcher.
And that's, you know, McCullers isn't at that level. But McCullers has his nights where he's got 7 fastball, 7 breaking ball. Maybe he's pushing an 8 with the fastball. So he's got 2 premium pitches. So the changeup does not have to
right
be.
But right now?
Right. Right now it's like a 3.
I'd say 2.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a scout. The night I saw it, and I was talking to scouts who were there, so I'm getting this. It's not just my personal observation. First 4 of them I saw, we were talking about it, you know, in kind of the scout section. It's like, I guess that's a changeup.
Yeah, exactly.
It was that bad. It was a BP fastball. Like there was nothing about it. There was not enough separation. It was straight. There was no late tumble or anything.
Right.
There was no real deception to it. There was no part of it that made you, if you wanted to say, you could project it as a 3-4.
And let's not forget, one thing that I think is important to remember with Lance McCullers is this was the second year of him as a starting pitcher. He did not start in high school baseball. Even on the showcase circuit, he didn't pitch more than 1 or 2 innings at a time until his senior year in high school. If he did, it was rare. But he really just started to, quote-unquote, pitch in 2012 as a senior in high school. And so this year, the fact that I think his year is one of the more encouraging years in that an organization that was full of encouraging seasons. The fact that he showed some pitchability this year, gave up only 3 home runs, the walk rate at 4.2 is better than Archie Bradley's at a similar stage. And Archie Bradley had a lot more experience as a pitcher than Lance McCullers has at a similar stage. I think it's a very encouraging season. And I think nothing will drive home pitchability more than Lancaster. So I think it would behoove them to send him there, and I think it's worthwhile to send a pitcher there. It's not worthwhile to send one there to suffer, but it is worthwhile to send one there to learn to survive.
I think part of it, though, is you got to know also the makeup.
Good point.
To put it this way, what we learned, one of the things we learned from Lancaster, Daniel Bard did not have the makeup to survive Lancaster.
He's exposed.
I mean,
he
really.
He's a sitting duck.
I mean, but there are guys who do. You can keep your head down. Basically, this is gonna be terrible in some ways, but I can make it through it, and I can be stronger for it.
Right.
I do think McCullers, from a little bit that I know, from talking, has that kind of bullheaded mentality where I think he can probably make it through that. Win the Midwest League.
He's a McCullers.
That staff had McCullers, had Vince Velasquez, had Mark Appel late in the year. Best way to put it, again, talking to a lot of scouts doing my Midwest League calls, Mark Appel, there's a lot of caveats to this.
Yeah.
He was coming off a long layoff because basically Stanford was done in mid-May. He was a little rusty. He was at the end of a long, long year because he started earlier than all these guys. That being said, the guys who saw both of them in the Midwest League, again, I'm not saying that means that Lance McCullers is a better prospect, but McCullers was better in that league, the two of them together, than Appel was.
And this is a good, to wrap up the hour-long podcast, but I didn't have Jonathan Gray come through my league, but in the Florida State League, but I did have Chris Bryant. And the top three consensus prospects in the 2013 draft, JJ, were Gray, Appel, Bryant, in some order. Mm-hmm. I believe that's the order we wrapped up with, was mm-hmm. Gray, Appel, Bryant on the BA 500. And Jonathan Gray just had a boffo debut. Mm-hmm. I mean, 37 innings, 25
hits. He's already survived the California League.
8 walks, 51 strikeouts. He went to the Pioneer League, which is as offensive as anywhere, probably one of the most offensive leagues in the minor leagues, with Grand Junction. But then he made 5 starts for Modesto, Gray pitcher in Modesto, and he was outstanding in Modesto. Only 3 runs in 24 innings, 6-36 walk-to-strikeout ratio.
And Chris was touching, and
hitting 100 miles an hour every time.
Right.
I mean, shorter. So you go from 7 days cycle to a 5-day cycle. Didn't affect Jonathan Gray.
Oh, okay. I'll just throw 100 anyway.
The velo was there. Maybe he didn't have the attention span to figure out that it was 5 days instead of 7, but that's a small little joke there. We'll just forget that joke. But Chris Bryant goes to the Florida State League, and every time I've talked to someone about Daytona, they're like, oh, man, Chris Bryant was legit. And, I mean, Daytona had Javier Baez and Jorge Soler putting on massive laser shows in the first half of the year. Chris Bryant fit right in with those guys. Right in there in terms of power. People even impressed with him at third base. Helps Daytona win a Florida State League championship. We don't hear that same kind of raves for Mark Appel. And, hey, Jonathan Gray was done about a week after Mark Appel. Chris Bryant was done a week after Mark Appel.
Right. No.
We just don't hear the same raves about Mark Appel that we heard about Gray and Bryant.
What I'm getting in the Midwest League from scouts when I ask, and I'm not bringing Appel out. He doesn't qualify in that league. But unsolicited, you get... You know what did surprise me? Mark Appel, I was expecting more. And they always follow it up with, I'm not saying he's not good.
Right.
But they're really what
it's a snapshot.
As a snapshot, they throw the caveats in there. But they say, you know what, though? The best way to put it is that you expect to get wow.
Yeah, when you're a pro guy, when you're there doing pro coverage, you didn't see Mark Appel during the year, but not like you don't know about him. You know
he went 1-1.
You know who went 1-1, and when you see 1-1, you come in expecting to see something. That's where that's where people go in there, and you hear that about Tim Beckham, and you heard about it for 5 years. Like, I was expecting this because he went 1-1, and then you watch him, and it's just not. He doesn't wow you. Is he a bad player? No, but he doesn't wow you. Mark Appel, are we saying he's going to be bad? No. It was just a snapshot.
The velocity. It was not the velocity.
Right.
It was not velocity. It was a lot of times the slider was not as good as it usually was when it was at Stanford.
As it was reputed to be.
Right. The body is not as good as they were expecting to see.
Right.
And the pitchability wasn't. They were expecting to see. They expected to see a guy who was basically at a graduate level facing, 101 level, English 101 students. And instead they saw a guy who seemed to be at the level of the guys he was facing, not ahead of them. Whereas, again, what we were hearing with Chris Bryant, with Jonathan Gray, is that you had guys who stepped in and felt like that they were ahead of the level of what they were facing.
That's a great way to put it. And, JJ, we could talk American League wild card race, but I think that would take a whole other podcast. So.
I think so. I think we did an hour on this, and I, as we always do, it's like, man, we could do 2. But we're going to stay.
Yeah, well, we could have kept talking about the win, but that, thank goodness that didn't happen. You get enough of that on MLB Now, which is we're still friends of theirs because they advertise in every print edition of the magazine. But hope you enjoyed the podcast. Obviously, if you ever have questions for the podcast, you can send those into podcast@baseballamerica.com. You can tweet at either one of us. I'm at John Manuel BA. He's at JJ Coop 36. And, of course, if you have other further questions or you want further questions explored, you can send those into AskBA at BaseballAmerica.com. J.J. Cooper now handling the reins at AskBA. For J.J., I'm John Manuel. We'll see you on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.